Okay, good morning and welcome to USIP. I'm Dorina Biko. I work in the Center for Analysis and Conflict Prevention. And we're here today to discuss the implications of a trial, of Charles Taylor on trial. About 2 weeks ago, we hosted President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in a virtual town hall meeting, which I understand was also viewed in Monrovia. So today, we're talking about the continuation of the peace process in Liberia. And Liberia is of interest to us because of our work on post-conflict reconstruction. And the Institute's Rule of Law program has also followed the work on the special court in Sierra Leone. And my colleague, Laurel Miller, will tell us a little bit more about that and introduce our speakers.
Final speaker just arrived. I'm Laurel Miller from the Rule of Law Program here at the Institute, and I'd like to add my own welcome to all of you. I'm glad to see there's so much interest in this important topic. The Rule of Law Program here at the Institute has had a long-standing interest in the work of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. Our activities with respect to the court have included involvement in the formulation of the rules governing the relationship of the court to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Sierra Leone. We've also helped to facilitate communications between personnel of the court and the NGO community, particularly here in Washington. And throughout our work on transitional justice issues, we've worked to draw lessons from the experience of the special court for other international criminal justice mechanisms. So we're very pleased to be able to welcome this panel here today. I'd like to quickly turn now to introducing our speakers. You have biographical information available on each of them in a handout, so I'll be brief in introducing the panel. First, we have Jacques Klein, who is the UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Liberia from 2003 to 2005. Previously, he served in several senior international positions in Bosnia and Herzegovina, including as Special Representative of the Secretary General there. He's a former senior U.S. diplomat and also a retired Major General of the U.S. Air Force, and he is now teaching at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. David Crane was the Chief Prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone from 2002 to 2005, and he is currently teaching international criminal law and other subjects at Syracuse University's College of Law. He served over 30 years in the U.S. federal government, including at the Department of Defense. Philip Banks was a member of the National Constitutional Commission of Liberia, where he served as a lead drafter of the current Liberian Constitution. He participated in conflict resolution negotiations throughout much of the 1990s in Liberia and served as Attorney General in the interim Government of National Unity. He's a former professor and dean of the Grimes School of Law at the University of Liberia, and he is author of a number of works concerning Liberian law and the legal system. Ismail Rashid has been teaching at Vassar College since 1998, where he focuses on a variety of topics related to African history. His research interests span the colonial to contemporary periods and include a focus on social and military conflicts in West Africa. We'll begin with the lawyers. No bias because I'm a lawyer, but we thought we would start with the legal issues implicated here, first with David Crane and then Philip Banks, whom we've asked to address issues such as the expected nature of a trial of Charles Taylor, any legal implications of a trial for Liberia, the impact of a trial on the special court, and the current debate over venue of the trial, whether it should be held in Freetown or whether it should be moved to The Hague. We'll then move to a discussion of the political implications of a trial, including the likely impact on the prospects for consolidating peace in Liberia and the broader regional implications. And we'll hear from Jacques Klein and Ismail Rashid on those and other points. A reminder to our speakers to please try to keep your remarks to 10 minutes each, and Dorina will help you keep track of time. Thank you. And let's start with David Crane.
Well, good morning. As I look out on the audience, I see many, many people who were of great assistance to me personally and professionally throughout the 3 years that I was in Sierra Leone trying to seek justice for the murder, rape, maiming, and mutilation of over 1.2 million human beings, a tragedy of almost World War II proportions. And, of course, certainly the individual who was the center point, along with Muammar Gaddafi, was Charles Taylor in this joint criminal enterprise. So it really is a special day for all of us who have worked so hard to show that international criminal justice can be efficiently and effectively delivered in a politically acceptable time frame. If you recall, at the time that President Kaba sent a letter to Kofi Annan in the summer of 2000 saying, I can't account for all of these people. I have no judiciary. They don't exist, or they have left the country. And that we are just not capable of domestically handling the tragedy, and ask that the United Nations consider doing something about this. Amazingly, they got this one right. You know, in the past, the ad hocs, and I'm not here to disparage our sister tribunals in Rwanda and in The Hague, but really, after I was appointed, the Security Council asked me, can we deliver international criminal justice effectively and efficiently in a politically acceptable time frame? So they created the world's first hybrid international war crimes tribunal with a workable mandate, which is, I think, the key to, I think, the apparent success of this tribunal in West Africa. And that mandate is what? Greatest responsibility. And as you know, all tribunals are created and are creatures of political events and political compromise. And politics runs a bright red thread throughout all of these tribunals through history, and particularly in the special court for Sierra Leone. I'm not saying this in a negative, but just in a practical and real way. And the compromise was greatest responsibility. And most nations would not have signed up for this if it hadn't been greatest responsibility. But what does that mean, greatest responsibility? What that means, what I was taking from this mandate, is that I was going to go after those who started this, aided it, abetted it, continued it, and created the conditions by which other individuals were able to murder, rape, maim, mutilate, pillage, plunder, enslave, etc., etc., etc. With a plan, which we began very shortly after I was appointed in April of 2002, we developed a 10-phase plan by which we would do this. We are currently in phase 10 of that plan, and it's moving forward. A little bit shifted as far as time is concerned with the detention of Charles Taylor, but it is still workable, and I think something that can be done within the politically acceptable time frame of around 5 years. So we look at the Special Court for Sierra Leone existing around between 2002 and 2007, where its work will largely be done. As you know, currently there are three joint criminal trials ongoing in Freetown against the leadership of the Civil Defense Force, the Revolutionary United Front, and the Armed Forces Revolutionary Council. Charles Taylor, our plan was to be rolled up into the joint criminal indictment with RUF, but that didn't take place. However, our plan was also, if it shouldn't happen, that of course certainly we would be using a great deal of the evidence that was against the RUF. Now, Charles Taylor was the center point of a geopolitical plan, a 10-year geopolitical plan that Muammar Gaddafi had started back in the late 80s and began to recruit various individuals to include Fodi Sanko, Blaise Campori, Ibrahim Ba, Charles Taylor, what have you, to move south and begin to foment rebellion and eventually take over the countries and be the surrogates for Muammar Gaddafi so that he could do whatever he wanted to do with West Africa. Clearly, we had clear evidence of this, and it'll be a very interesting trial related to this part of the case against him, and that is the strategic political implications and the reasons why they did this. You know, you're sitting there looking at these mutilated and maimed human beings, and of course, as a human being, you're always saying, how, why? It's just a human thing to do. And the answer is, because they could. And this is a very unique conflict, this civil war in Sierra Leone, and I use civil war in quotes because it is an unusual conflict. It was created, started by criminals for their own personal criminal gain. And in that mix, you have politicians, you have financiers, you have generals, boy generals, and a whole mix of, you have terrorists, you have Ukrainian and Russian mafia, all operating over a period of about 20 years, really sucking West Africa dry for their natural resources and for their personal criminal gain. So right in the middle of all of this, we arrived in August of 2002 and began to unravel this particular tragedy that took place. And what we really found was a joint criminal enterprise set up to take the diamonds out of eastern Sierra Leone, to use this as a base to finance this geopolitical plan of Muammar Gaddafi to take over a large portion of West Africa politically. And this, by the way, continues, in my opinion. Now, as I said, the result was the of this joint criminal enterprise for their own personal use and criminal gain was the murder, rape, maiming, and mutilation of 500,000 people in Sierra Leone and about 600,000 in Liberia. And I'll just digress here very quickly. As a community, we're going to have to start considering a hybrid international war crimes tribunal for Liberia. All of these crimes took place outside of the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. And we cannot walk away from 600,000 human beings. You know, the ultimate atrocity in my mind is that we don't do something and these people go quietly into the night and there's no record of their horrible deaths. And I really want to underscore horrible deaths. As a base of this, in March 3rd of 2003, I signed indictment number one against Charles Genge Taylor of 17 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Now, that indictment has been even more consolidated for a tighter case against him, and now it's 11 counts of murder, rape, maiming, mutilation, pillage, plunder, enslavement, attacks on UN peacekeepers, as well as child soldiers. Many of these crimes being charged for the first time in history. Now, as you know, around 10 days ago, Charles Taylor was finally arrested as he was moving north towards the Cameroonian border, with the full knowledge, I might add, of President Obasanjo. And as soon as President Obasanjo realized the political blowback that was about to happen in the United States as well as the international community, when he was personally told by the National Security Advisor, Steve Hadley, that you will not see the President of the United States tomorrow if you do not find Charles Taylor. And guess what? A couple hours later, they found Charles Taylor. Now, I was in London, Ontario, and I got a call at 4 in the morning saying they got him. That's kind of an interesting phrase. I said, what, Saddam Hussein? And I said, no, they got Charles Taylor. And I, of course, that was a great day, and I couldn't sleep anymore. At about 6 o'clock, I got another phone call from some individuals who worked for us as operatives, for lack of a better term, confirming all of this. And then, of course, Desmond De Silva, my successor, confirmed that about 6:30. I said, well, look, just do me this one favor. When he is safely in his cell, and I remember years looking at his cell right across the street from my office, could you just call me? And he said, I would be glad to. And of course, you saw that on CNN. Well, that's happening. I'm giving a speech very much like this in London, Ontario, at the University of Western Ontario School of Law. And I told the audience, I said, look, I'm awaiting a phone call. And I said, if it rings, I'm going to have to take it. Well, I gave the speech, and just as I finished, we were starting question and answers, the phone vibrated, and I was able to tell the audience, and they all stood up and applauded. A great moment for international criminal justice and the victims that suffered so tragically. Now, there are some. The rest of the story is really going to follow our rules of criminal procedure and evidence. It's routine. We have an indictee. He is charged with 11 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity. He has been arraigned. He has pled not guilty, and I might add, he behaved himself. And then the decision now is to what do we do with him? Now, our original plan, when we did get him, was to move him at The Hague anyway, just to get him out of West Africa and let the dust settle. And over time, all of these tyrants, these warlords, these thugs, their influence tends to wane. We've seen that from from Goring all the way through Milosevic and Saddam Hussein, what have you. So the plan was just to get him out of West Africa, let the dust settle, get the case ready, and go to trial. So that was the original thinking. And, of course, as you see, the thinking also is to go ahead and to try the case in The Hague. That can be done. The statute, Article 4 of the statute, allows for the special court to try anyone who bears the greatest responsibility pretty much anywhere in the world where it makes sense. The president of the court said, for security reasons, we might want to move this to The Hague. What that means is we're just borrowing space from the International Criminal Court. The special court will just try the case there. Personally, I think because of the beauty of having the tribunal in the middle of the conflict where the people can see justice done, it really would be great to see Charles Taylor sitting in the dock answering for those crimes. And I'll give you a vignette. You know, when you're sitting there trying these guys and you have these people let in missing various body parts, and you see one of them point their stump at the accused saying, "You did this to me," because their hand is missing, and then walk out proudly with their head held high past these guys. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll conclude, that is justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll now hear from Mr. Banks, who will elaborate a little further on the implications of a trial.
Good morning. I guess we probably should have gotten different aspects of this thing after David Queen had spoken. I started to wonder what was I going to say. A lot of the things I was going to say he's already talked about. But let me focus myself mostly on Liberia. Firstly, and this is not to criticize the UN, but I will dare to say that if not for the UN, Mr. Taylor may have seen the jailhouse in 1992. I recall at the time when I was Minister of Justice and Mr. Taylor was what we call a rebel leader, a series of massacres had been carried out in Liberia. And one of such massacres was the Carter Camp massacre. I recall that the atrocities committed in that camp were of such magnitude that I had determined to personally head the investigation team. And we had gathered a wealth of evidence on the basis of which we had issued out an indictment from Mr. Taylor. At the time, we had also called the UN in to assist us in the matter. Unfortunately, and I will not go into the details of how they conducted the hearings, but they came up with a report stating that Mr. Taylor was not responsible for the atrocities that had been committed, in spite of what we believe were the enormous evidence that we had gathered in the premises. So Mr. Taylor was allowed to go free. Under our law, he would have been tried and he would have been brought to justice. In any event, let me come to the present. Personally, I am of the strong opinion that, yes, Mr. Taylor did commit crimes against humanity. And that as a consequence of the commission of those crimes, he should be tried. I have examined the statute of the special court in Sierra Leone, and I believe that they do have the authority to try Mr. Taylor for the crimes that he's committed. My problem is that the authority that's granted the court is so circumscribed that Mr. Taylor can be tried only for offenses which he committed against Sierra Leone. And that's why I said David had taken out a lot of what I wanted to say, because I wanted to point out that I thought that Liberia was not getting out of the international intervention what it deserved, given that the atrocities committed in Liberia from our own study were even greater than those committed in Sierra Leone. I say that all of these atrocities committed by Mr. Taylor against Liberia, for which I believe strongly he should be tried. But I want to go one step further, because I think the statute of the special court in Sierra Leone, again I come to the statute, is so circumscribed that it limits effectively the prosecution of a lot of the individuals who were associated with the conflict, the leaders of all of the warring factions who participated in tremendous atrocities over a period of more than a decade. They can't be reached by that court, because that court can try only individuals whose activities impacted on Sierra Leone. In my opinion also, I think, just as David had said, there is a need now to set up a tribunal for Liberia. And there are a number of reasons that I have for advocating this position. One is, again, as David has said, there was more than one person. And I'm talking leadership in certain countries in Africa who were involved in the perpetration of the atrocities that were committed in that region, and whose action in support of those atrocities, in my opinion, constituted their complicity in the crimes against humanity. Specifically, I can point to the Cote d'Ivoire. I can point to Burkina Faso. I mean, when I was Minister of Justice, we continuously informed the Ivorian government of hundreds of truckloads of ammunition that were passing through the center of Abidjan, headed for Mr. Taylor in Liberia. Weapons which he used to massacre thousands of people. I think that if a tribunal is set up for Liberia using the same premise as Sierra Leone, we should call those individuals to account for their compliance and their complicity in the atrocities that occurred. I believe also that if a tribunal is set up for Liberia, we'll be able to then have all of the individuals who were involved both in the Liberian conflict and those who participated in the conflict in Sierra Leone, but who are not currently under the jurisdiction of the court in Sierra Leone, we'll have those individuals brought before the Liberian tribunal. An international tribunal for Liberia. And I believe that that this should be done. I believe it should be done because, additionally, I'm sure many of you know, some of the individuals who were closely associated with Mr. Taylor are today holding some big positions in the government. Some of them were elected. These are people who committed war crimes. I have difficulty same people who have committed those kinds of atrocities holding positions in the government. And I think that they should be prosecuted. I think also that a lot of them did accumulate substantial wealth during the period that they worked with and assisted Mr. Taylor. And this takes me to the point that David made about moving the trial to The Hague. I don't want to boast, but Mr. Dukley will confirm, because he and I worked together with the interim government. This Mr. Taylor was a person we studied. And immediately we learned that he had disappeared. I said, the biggest wish is apprehend the man, because he has the propensity to go into a situation where he will create additional disturbance in the region. And it will not be so much that he wants to assume power, as much as it is because of what he would feel is the disgrace that's brought to him by having to be indicted by an international tribunal. And in Seoul, if Mr. Taylor is tried in that jurisdiction, I have a fear that given the wealth that some of his supporters have, they may not hesitate to support his activity. And that may even include, I was saying to a colleague on the way here, that one reason I think one can justify removal of the trial from Freetown, Sierra Leone to The Hague, it's just the very short experience. Here was a man who was supposed to be heavily guided, and no one knew where he had gone. I mean, how did he disappear? My fear is that Sierra Leone does not present an environment that is far greater than the environment that the Nigerians presented, and that there is a strong possibility, I do believe, there is a strong possibility that if Mr. Taylor is tried or if he is kept in Seoul, we may wake up one morning and find out that he can't be found. And that would be critical. But those are some of the points. I think I've run out of my time, so I have to stop. But I guess we'll probably take some matters in questioning period. Thank you.
Thanks. We'll now hear from Ambassador Klein.
We have to be brief, but I want to acknowledge two people who are here today. Dr. Peter Pham is here from James Madison University. As you know, Peter is the author of Liberia, the Failed State, which is an excellent synopsis of the problems that Liberia really faced, and has been there as an election monitor on a number of occasions and knows the country intimately. And Stephanie Fries, who was with us in Bosnia and who, for want of an hour or two, would have had Karadzic in our hands at that time and in jail. But at that time, even though we thought we had a deal, his brother talked him out of it, unfortunately. Now, to be quick, my daughter came home recently and asked me what an essay was. And I said, an essay is a short, very precise, tightly drafted piece focused on one topic. And if you pick a subject, do that well, you should get a good grade. So she ran off and did her thing and came home about 3 weeks later, and I said, well, how did it go? She said, I did. I got a good grade. I said, what did you write about? She said, well, let me read it to you. She said, I picked a Greek philosopher. And she said, Socrates was a Greek philosopher. He talked too much. They killed him. So that's as tight drafting as you're going to get. Now, last night, my son brought over. He said, you're going to do this tomorrow. Let me give you this film. I think it's called The Lords of War with Nicolas Cage, which is a half-a-star film. I mean, it's terrible. But the subject it conveys, and they have Charles Taylor in a Citroen. We know he doesn't drive Citroens. He only drives a Mercedes. But all in all, it did convey some of the terror and the blood diamonds and all these other things that we well know about. My participation in this goes back to arriving in Liberia in August of 2003. And I wanted to see, and last night I pulled out my notes to see if we were consistent. August 2003, President Taylor must leave and ultimately be brought to justice. March 2004, for this reason, I would urge the Security Council to add its voice to the appeals that have been made, including recently by the European Parliament, for Taylor to be handed over to the special court. Many Liberians remain convinced that lasting peace will not return to Liberia until Taylor is in the detention cells of the special court. The key objectives for which he was taken out of Liberia and given asylum have been achieved. The war has ended and disarmament has been completed. It is now time to ensure that he faces justice and to reassure the people of the troubled West African subregion that impunity will not be tolerated. The argument that Charles Taylor's appearance before the special court in Sierra Leone would destabilize Liberia or the subregion is a specious one. The opposite is true. Many pro-Taylor Liberians will tell you candidly that they know they have no political future in Liberia unless he returns. They obfuscate, avoid, delay, and undermine much of what we're trying to do. A second larger group will tell you that there will be much more cooperation and progress by many sectors of the society if they knew that Taylor was incarcerated and would not be returning. They fear his return. The culture of impunity has existed far too long. It's time we put an end to it. Ultimately, until you punish the guilty, you cannot absolve the innocent. June 2005. Mr. President, in recent months there has been increasing pressure from the special court for Sierra Leone and other sources to hand over to the court former President Charles Taylor, who is currently in Nigeria on asylum. These calls have gathered momentum following persistent allegations in the media that Mr. Taylor is attempting to influence developments in Liberia in violation of his asylum conditions. There are also allegations that Mr. Taylor was involved in, quote, unquote, an assassination attempt on the President of Guinea. UNMIL has not been able to confirm these allegations. However, in Liberia, the National Patriotic Party is currently divided over claims by some of its senior officials that Mr. Taylor interfered in the selection process for the party's presidential candidate. In addition, it has been alleged that Mr. Taylor is trying to finance several other presidential contenders in an attempt to ensure that the newly elected president will be kindly disposed toward him. Nigeria maintains that it extended asylum to Mr. Taylor based on the understanding reached between all stakeholders in the Liberian peace process, including the Liberian parties, the AU, ECOWAS, and the UN. It strongly denies that Taylor has violated the conditions of his asylum and stresses that it cannot renege on an understanding that led it to grant Mr. Taylor asylum. However, it has expressed a willingness to hand over Mr. Taylor to an elected government. The Nigerian position is supported by both the transitional government and ECOWAS. During a recent second meeting of the coordination mechanism between the transitional government, ECOWAS, and the UN, ECOWAS emphasized the special court and others who are calling on Nigeria to hand over Mr. Taylor to the court must present evidence that he has violated his asylum conditions. UNMIL's position on this is clear, and it's guided by the Secretary General's views, which were set out in a letter sent to the special court last year. The Secretary General stated that it's for the Security Council to decide on any further action that should be taken by the UN, that Taylor must be brought to trial, et cetera, et cetera. So we have been consistent. And when I first arrived in Liberia, I called David up, and I was surprised, as Mr. Barnes alluded, that the crimes for which Mr. Taylor was going to be tried were uniquely focused on Sierra Leone. What about the 200-some thousand people killed in Liberia? What about the other thugs and murderers in Liberia? And then I called The Hague and talked to the prosecutor, who was a very dynamic Argentine who put many of those generals and admirals in jail. And he said, unfortunately, we have a problem. The Hague can't do it. It's ex post facto because the court was established after the crimes were committed. However, moving physically the court from Sierra Leone to The Hague is certainly possible. I explored with David at the time, could we expand the mandate of the court to Liberia? Cannot be done. No interest at all. At several meetings, both Nigeria and Ghana and the transitional administration strongly opposed any movement of this kind, any interest in war crime trials in Liberia itself. I had put a small, a very specialized unit of personnel who began collecting war crimes materials in Liberia. We still have the container. It's at the JFK Hospital, full of bone fragments, clothing, weapons casings, and other information, which ultimately, hopefully, will lead to some trials and convictions. When I presented this container and the information in it to the Supreme Court Justice of Liberia, he immediately said, I don't want to hear about this. I'm going to recuse myself. We need nothing like this for 10 or 15 years. We don't want the problem. And that's unfortunately some of the dilemma that we have had. Also, you recall that before Taylor left, he issued an amnesty for himself and all the other members of the Liberian government. which we very quickly sidelined. And at Accra, I must tell you, that all three warring factions gave each other amnesty, which was very clever. You know, we're all killers, but what the hell, you know. So I called them in. I said, look, you can amnesty spitting on sidewalk, chewing gum in public. You can do all of that, but you do not amnesty as long as I'm around war crimes or crimes against humanity. So this is an ongoing problem. And I'm hoping, however, that now we will see justice done. The other dilemma you have, there's a lot of hypocrisy in all of this. Now, I'll read you the Security Council resolution. The Security Council decides that to prevent further Liberian President Charles Taylor, his immediate family members, in particular Jewel Howard Taylor, Charles Taylor Jr., senior officials of the former Taylor regime, to blah, 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 financial assets should be seized, economic sanctions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we have a sanctions list, right, and a travel ban. It's right here. Now, when the special representative of the Secretary General in Liberia went to the Security Council and said, now, I want to exercise this. I'm going to seize the property. I'm going to detain individuals. And as you know, some of them are in the present government. Here's what I received back. The members of the committee gave careful consideration to your communication during their informal consultations of 10 May 2004. During the discussion, several members observed that decisions regarding UNMIL's role in monitoring and enforcing sanctions compliance fall outside the scope of the committee. The members did note, however, that your communication of the information concerning the freezing of assets conveyed to the Secretary of Committee will be duly looked into. And this was followed by the following. Reference to our discussion, Security Council Resolutions 1599 does not mandate UNMIL to take any action to enforce sanctions on behalf of the Sanctions Committee. Likewise, neither do Resolutions 1521 or 1532. Relating to the sanctions on Liberia, call upon UNMIL to take any action in this regard. Well, then why the hell do we do this? It makes us feel good. So that means all these people on the sanctions list, Cyril Allen, former head of the MPP, the present speaker of the Assembly of the Government of Liberia, basically the Security Council has said, we did this, they are under sanctions, they cannot travel, but you, the legal authority that operates and speaks for us, do not have the authority to carry that out. I'm pleased that Mr. Barnes is here as a graduate of the Grimes School of Law. If you recall, in the 50s and 60s, the Grimes School of Law drew candidates and students from all over West Africa. I mean, Sekou Touré, Nkrumah, all these people, Sekou Touré and Nkrumah, the rest of them, were all gravitating to Liberia during that period. And I'm pleased to say that in my last two UN missions, both in Croatia, I had the Honorable Winston Tubman as my attorney, and in Sarajevo, Bosnia-Herzegovina, I had the Honorable Johnny Lewis as my attorney, who I understand is now going to become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Liberia. The problem we've had with Taylor all this time is his constant meddling and interference, but we know that in Africa, chiefs do not turn in chiefs, and that's a problem I think we've had. The main thing I blame Taylor for is that he criminalized his whole society by not paying anyone. By corrupting society to the level he did, it makes it very difficult to rebuild the whole social consciousness, construct of integrity in the police and all the other institutions of government. I'm worried about one thing, however, that the Taylor phenomenon now, the Taylor publicity, the media rush, will divert from what Liberia desperately needs, and that is international investment. We have a government in Liberia that is operating with a budget of about $84-85 million a year. Monrovia is still a city of 1,400,000 people without running water, without electricity, with no sewage system. The telephone system are two cell nets, one Israeli, excuse me, and one Lebanese. The educational system is defunct. The medical system is defunct. So I hope we don't get too far along the path of focusing too much on Taylor. Yes, Taylor, what he did should be publicized. And there's one argument that could be made for keeping him in the region, that if it's in the region, the population would actually be aware on a daily basis of what goes on. Because you'll also be accused of racism if you move him to The Hague. That's a dilemma. You have to be aware of that. That's going to be a given. And also, we have to be concerned that in Liberia, people do tend to circle the wagon. He may be a killer, but he's our killer. So we'll deal with it. So that's a dilemma. But I'm hoping that Ellen, President Johnson Sirleaf, very quickly looks at Liberia itself in terms of establishing a court mechanism, court structure, et cetera, to begin trying those others who were certainly part and parcel of the whole Taylor cabal, and who, by the way, enriched themselves greatly, to the point where Charles Taylor, what he used to call them and say, I'm a little short of Pinza Pinza, and they would say, who are you? It's me, it's, you know, the boss. Oh, where are you now? You know. So they did rather well after his departure and were not necessarily receptive or forthcoming when he called on them for a certain amount of largesse. So I think for all of us, for David who was there and the others who were involved in all this, I got a call saying that in 10 minutes the helicopter will land at Mamayoka Airport at Freetown and Taylor is on board. I said, that's wonderful. Now, how do we go about getting the others? What they did is unconscionable. I still find it hard to understand the level of violence, the level of cruelty, the level of barbarity, how thin the veneer of civilization ultimately is. And that frightens me even more. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll now hear from Professor Ishmael Rasid, who will give us some idea of the regional implications.
Thank you very much, Dorina, and thank you all of you for being here today. One thing that I want to get quickly out of the way before I sort of forget this is, first, I'm sort of very strongly on the side that Charles Taylor should be kept in the region. He should be tried in the region so that he faces the people whose lives and whose bodies have been mutilated. In other words, for all of the crimes that he's that he's accused of, that he actually faced the victims of that particular of those crimes. I think moving him to the Hague for some of the reasons that Mr. Klein has just pointed out just complicates the picture. He's going to have sort of very nice, decent cell in the Hague, conjugal and spousal visits as Milosevic and the other people are. But in this particular case, he is forced in the particular region. And I'll speak to why it is immensely important that the trial of Charles Taylor be got right within that particular context. Because really from where I stand, and if you travel frequently to Sierra Leone, Charles Taylor, I mean, there are 11 people being tried now by the special court. But really in terms of the symbolic value of the special court in Sierra Leone, for now Charles Taylor is really, in terms of the regional mode, is really one of the only significant people that the special court has now. The other 11 people that are on trial do not ignite the kind of passion that Charles Taylor does ignite. I want to talk about four things very briefly in terms of the regional implications of Charles Taylor's trial. The first is the public mood in the region and what's going on. The second is the issue of political accountability and in impunity justice against the background of essentially a two-decade-old conflict. The third is the issue of political and regional stability, which has been touched on. And the last is the larger issue of diplomacy and conflict resolution insofar as West Africa is concerned, because the position that Nigeria has found itself in the past 2 weeks, as has been pointed out, Obasanjo did not do this very easily. He did this very, very reluctantly. Anybody who follows the news, and if you and as the various speakers have pointed out, if you're privy to what's going on, it was clear that Charles Taylor was being tracked, that the Nigerians never lost track on Charles Taylor, that it took the leverage for the United States to actually say, well, Charles, this is the end of the line. But in terms of the first point, public mood in the region, if you've surveyed or if you follow the press very closely since his arrest, the public mood in the region spans jubilation to, of course, resentment. And overwhelmingly in the region, and I need to point this out, overwhelmingly in the region, the mood has been one of jubilation that Charles Taylor has been docked and is going to have his day in court. In other words, for people in Guinea, for people in Liberia, and for people in Sierra Leone whose lives have been implicated, whose lives have been largely under the shadow of Charles Taylor, this for them is a great moment. I say this against the background of the fact that in March, April 1999, I was in Sierra Leone. I was one of the few people who was called up to leave my job to see whether or not we could find a basis in the middle of a capital that was burning to find a basis for us to have some kind of peace resolution in which the suffering would stop. This was a time in which you had sort of about 3 to 6 hours of free time in Sali, in which you had something like 15 to 18 hour curfew. People were up 9 in the morning, about 3 in the afternoon. Everybody had to be in because of the insecurity of the situation. And one of the harrowing moments of my life was moving to the east, to the eastern of Freetown, and taking that particular risk and driving for something like 5-6 kilometers into what essentially was the war front zone. I'm just literally seeing smoldering cars. I mean, cars and buildings destroyed as the armed forces, the RAF, and Charles Taylor's minions pulled away from Freetown as they were being pushed by Echo Mob and the other church. I mean, you don't want to be in that particular moment. And there's still bodies in the street from the war. And this, for many Sierra Leoneans at that particular moment, Charles Taylor, there were three people on the air, three people who were constantly in the face of the international media. It was the spokesman of the RAF, Mosquito, who is now dead, Charles Taylor, and occasionally you would have government speaker. Charles Taylor loomed so large in terms of what was going on in Freetown in 1999. 6 years later, it might not seem that he was that physically present, he was that vocal in terms of the way the conflict played out. For all of those people who in Sierra Leone felt a sense of powerlessness, a sense of hopelessness, a sense of victimization for what's going on, Charles Taylor appearing in Sierra Leone in Anchor was a great day for them. That 6 years ago, it did not seem as if this man who seemed so powerful, who seemed like a giant, that his day would come in cup. Of course, the resentment comes from Charles Taylor's people in Liberia, and we can talk about that. But also what's interesting in terms of the press mood across the region is that people are talking about anxiety, about our West African skills, almost uniformly, including in Liberia. If you follow the Liberian press, the Liberians who suffered perhaps more egregiously than Sierra Leone, because they had to, their conflict, even with Charles Taylor in power, was a long 15, 16-year conflict continuously. The press in Liberia almost uniformly celebrated the arrest and detention of Liberia. I thought this particular statement that came from John Sembemol was interesting. Charles Ganke, McCarthy, Boy, Dakpana Taylor, the small man with many names and a set of inward teeth like a boa constrictor, is the last of the world's most notorious criminal trials. His partners in crime against humanity are Iraq Saddam Hussein and the late Serbian strongman Slobodan Milosevic. This is the nature of the visceral response that's coming out of Liberia. The second point in terms of political accountability and ending impunity and justice for war victims, let me say this. It's at the end of the day, Charles Taylor, when Charles Taylor is tried, and I do hope, I'm not supposed to say this because lawyers, that he's indicted and he's convicted and he's jailed, it's more comfort. It's more comfort because Charles Taylor's crime has entered into the realm where it's beyond the pale. There is no, for the victims of Charles Taylor's war, there can never be any earthly justice for the scale of the crimes that he committed. In a sense, part of the discussion that we have and what the law can do is sort of a very narrow indictment of trial, of trying to find evidence that links Charles Taylor. What the law can never do in West Africa, what the law can never do is gauge essentially two decades of what you could call arrested, if not retarded, development that Charles Taylor was the center of. I mean, the law can never, the justice that's given to Charles Taylor can never help us close that gap as much as we can in 2 decades. And you have to travel around West Africa, you have to travel in Sierra Leone and Liberia to see the extent which, in states which were very weak, to have the scale of the tragedy that we have, the struggling that's going on. Freetown has been without light for what is it? When I came of age, I remember the light going off in Freetown, and it's almost 25 years without light. Those who are from Liberia remember the lights going off, and in Liberia it's almost 2 decades without electricity. We can flick a switch on and the light is on. living in this particular part of the world, you take it for granted, and you don't know what the lack of energy in a contemporary world does and the way it cripples people's lives. And Charles Taylor stands in the middle. One good thing about Charles Taylor being on the dock is, and I think this is the most important thing, is we need to demystify power in West Africa. And the big man in chains going to the prison is immensely far more important than perhaps him being tried in the eggs and having also those wonderful lawyers put him in the dock. Charles Taylor has begun, from the point of view of most West Africans, begun to serve time. It's a crucial moment. It's a symbolic moment, but it's a crucial moment. The end of his partner in crime, Fodi Sanko, started when Fodi Sanko did the same thing like Charles Taylor, escaped, and he was captured, and he was stripped naked. And the mood was, it's over, it's over. And from that point, it was downhill. So the first thing is mystification of power. And as Mr. Klein points out, is people like Charles Taylor who've loomed so large, is their power tends to wane over time. Is Charles Taylor power has started to win, and it's going to win considerably. And this is important. It's important in the sense that, in terms of the regional implication, it becomes for us in West Africa another crucial step in changing the political culture. In changing the political culture is we're trying to put with the rebuilding in Liberia and Sierra Leone and what's going on in Nigeria, mechanisms for political leadership at the highest point to be accountable. And this offers a way, this is the beginning of a process in which we could have some of that accountability. Very quickly, and I'm running out of time, the two other points that I want to speak. It's the regional and political implication of this. Well, it's Charles Taylor, but we're talking about sort of a network of destabilization within the region. Muammar Gaddafi has been mentioned, but I didn't hear Blaise Compaoré mentioned. Ivory Coast, Burkina Faso essentially provided the some of the training camps for the RAF and the NPLF soldiers who destabilized West Africa. Blaise Compaoré is deeply implicated in this through the Libya, through the Ivory Coast, through the Liberia, Sierra Leone network. So here we have sort of a lot of West African leaders that are probably very edgy. At another level, and I think this point has been made, and this is just to underline the point, in terms of the two countries which are very closely associated with Taylor's arrest. The first is Liberia. This is going to make President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's job incredibly difficult. I'm not so much worried at the level of destabilization, because I think, again, like Sierra Leoneans, Liberians are beginning to invest in peace, and I think the UNMIL is helping build that. What I'm worried about is really she has positioned herself as a very astute and as a very dynamic person, is the kind of rear guard battles that she has to fight now with the fact that the government is surrounded by all of these Taylor loyalists and all of these people who are connected to him. Sierra Leone, the problem with Sierra Leone, I don't think it's with security. I think that the special court on the UN should put the money where the mouth is that they should beef up the security around the special court. I mean, they didn't. IEF has more loyalists in Sierra Leone than probably Taylor. They didn't go to Spring, Charles Taylor. They didn't go to Spring for the Sankara. And I have no fear that they would go. What I'm worried about is really the fact that the Sierra Leone government and political situation is very unstable. We've had a government that unfortunately has not been the kind of government that should run Sierra Leone in the post-war period. In that particular sense, I think Mrs. Johnson has positioned itself and has a better vision than President Kabbah. So here it's the internal instability of the Sierra Leone political system that I'm more worried about than Charles Taylor. The last point, and this is the concluding point, is what this means in terms of larger diplomatic processes and peacemaking in West Africa. Ending the war in Liberia, getting Charles Taylor to Nigeria was a part of both the kind of understanding that emerged within the international community in terms of how you bring peace to Liberia and the conflict. But it was also part of an informal peacemaking process of which Nigeria is the leading power broker in the region. The last sentence to end is that if we have another conflict in the region, would Nigeria be trusted when it comes to peacemaking or peace break, resolving conflict? I'm thinking specifically of Ivory Coast. Would the new forces leader under this context agree that we can have that particular kind of peace? Thank you very much.
Open up the discussion for questions, unfortunately David Crane has to leave at around 11:30, so if there are a couple of questions specifically for Mr. Crane, I'd like to start with those, and then we'll open it up more broadly.
The special court has been such a...
We have a microphone there, so thank you.
Jane Stromseth from Georgetown University. The special court has made such an effort on outreach, reaching out to the population of Sierra Leone, and I'm very sympathetic to the idea of keeping Taylor there for that, among other reasons. But I'm wondering if, David, you could talk a little bit more about, elaborate a little bit more on your own views about whether he should stay in Sierra Leone, which I guess you hinted he should, and if he is moved to The Hague, what could be done to continue this effort to reach out more broadly to the population and build capacity within Sierra Leone.
Thank you, Jane. I think it's a very important question, because at the end of the day, and we have to really start focusing on this, I know that Luis Marino Ocampo, my friend at the ICC, really believes this as well, is at the end of the day, these tribunals, whether they be a regional hybrid or the ICC, have to understand that these tribunals now are for and about the people. And I recognized that very early on, and as you well know, I had a town hall program that proved to be, I think, pretty successful, where I literally walked the countryside listening to my client tell me what took place, and then over a period of 2.5 years, went back and just listened to them tell me how we were doing, and had that feedback. We developed an outreach program with district officers who constantly fed information to the populace on the trials that were ongoing in Freetown. Now, it's very difficult when you're living in Washington, D.C., where you have instant access anywhere in the world by a touch of a finger, when you have no roads, really no telephones, no television, BBC radio pretty much, and that's it, focus on Africa, to try to ensure that the people get information on what their court is doing. And I really commend the wonderful work of Binta Mansour and her outreach team do every day. So that's very, very important, and of course that will be a challenge if, for whatever appropriate reason, the court is, for this particular trial, now again, you need to understand this is just this particular trial, the rest of the trials remain in Freetown. The challenge is that we still have to get the information back out, and really the court really believes in this, getting the information back out to the people, the victims, their families, what have you, as to what is going on, and that's proved to be problematic in Arusha, where the infrastructure is a little better, and it's still very much of a problem in The Hague and the Balkans, and the infrastructure still is a problem. Yes, it would be wonderful to see the man. I mean, it was wonderful to see the man being arraigned. You don't understand, Jack alluded to this as well, you don't understand the almost magical power of this man. I mean, you didn't see on CNN, but my former special assistant, Harpinder Atwal, who's now Desmond De Silva's special assistant, called me in tears. And she said, you don't understand that, you know, the special court sits in a bowl and there's high ground all around, and there's also, and those of you that have been there, there's also houses. She said there were thousands of people in the hills and standing on the roofs of these houses, cheering and crying, and I mean, it was just incredible moment for justice throughout the world, and particularly in Africa. So it would be wonderful to see this tried there. But this movement is gaining some momentum, I fear, being driven by various states, to include an insecure Sierra Leone and an insecure Liberia, to get this guy out. Our plan originally was just to move him out, as I told you, and let the dust settle and then bring him back. Because, again, it is very important that these tyrants over time do lose their power very, very quickly. It remains to be seen. I don't know where this is all going to be going. I certainly have made my comment that it should be tried in Freetown. But again, having been there, lived, breathed it, touched it, tasted it, I don't want to second-guess those there that are there now. They will make whatever appropriate decision that has to be made. Hopefully it'll be certainly the trial in Freetown. But if not, I do know that the tremendous outreach program that we have will just be extended, and we'll continue to give the people of Sierra Leone all the information that they need to understand what is going on.
Thank you. Next question, and as Jane helpfully did, please do identify yourself.
Yes, my name's Kay Maddox. I'm from Voice of America. It's a question for Mr. Crane. Can you tell me why the court was originally set up in Sierra Leone and not Liberia, given that he was a leader and a rebel leader in Liberia? And also your thoughts on why Nigeria was so reluctant to hand him over when they were part of this whole deal to get him out. And I had one final question for the panel, if they wanted to take it, is if anyone could talk a little bit about the mindset of this criminal, of this man. He seems, as everyone has described, larger than life, beyond words in terms of the destruction. Does anybody understand what motivates him other than a sense of grandiosity? Thank you.
Sure. As I alluded to in my opening remarks, the special court was set up specifically to try those who bear the greatest responsibility for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and other serious violations of humanitarian law, stemming from the civil war in Sierra Leone on the date of November of 1996 and forward. So yes, it is a very narrow mandate. But again, I have to tell you that in that mandate is the seed of success. And so we focused on Sierra Leone. But all along, in my mind, I knew Charles Taylor, Blaise Campori, and I didn't quite understand completely at the time the full extent of Muammar Gaddafi in this. But certainly, the court was set up to address the tragedy in Sierra Leone. The international community was not ready to take on anything else. And as I told you again, it had to be greatest responsibility. It had to be less than 24 or so in my mind. It had to be quick, efficient, in and out, or we would have thrown the baby out with the bathwater related to international criminal justice. And so you have to understand that politics does play a little bit of, it's a bright red thread throughout the process. It's a naive prosecutor, and many of you have heard me say this, that just goes in and says, here's the law, here are the facts, I'm going to try everybody until it all finishes. You will literally destroy the very institution by which you were created. So you have to not wish what you had, but you have to do what you must do. And I think that is very critical. Nigeria. You know, in my mind, the biggest threat to the region is Nigeria. Nigeria plays a huge role in many, many things, in many, many aspects. You know, there's the West Africa that you see, and then there's the West Africa that is. And you have to understand, or at least try to appreciate or work in the West Africa that is. And Nigeria plays a huge role in both levels. Nigeria did not, you know, President Obasanjo did not want to turn Charles Taylor over for many reasons. It's a north-south issue. An issue that he was advocating when he was the president of the African Union, African solutions to African problems, using that little trite phrase to get out from underneath international norms and say, well, it's an African problem. Let us deal with it in an African way. And I respect that, in the sense of the general concept. But what he was doing and what he was saying is that, and I heard him say this in London personally, is that when an African leader commits crimes, that we can maybe do something like the Kachacha courts. Yes, the Kachacha courts are important, and we do really must respect and understand cultural approaches to these tragedies, because we can't prosecute everybody. It's impossible. You know, the standard is from now on to do this right is greatest responsibility, whether you like that or not. I'm just telling you, practically speaking, it has to be greatest responsibility. You can't prosecute 30,000 people, which would have been my level if they had just told me to prosecute everybody. It could not be done. Even if they said most responsible, it would have been about 100 to 300. That would have taken me 25 years. What you need to do is get these tribunals in and out. But I'm digressing. I'm very bothered about Nigeria. I think that the attitude that they reflected related to the movement of Charles Taylor outside of Calabar, which I supported initially, peace first, then justice. But then as we began to understand, we had a very effective information network that we had developed over 3 years in West Africa. We knew very much that, and this continues to be true, is that there was a payment by Charles Taylor to President Obasanjo. I don't know the exact amount. We do have other rumblings related to affairs and associations by family, what have you, so that there was a personal reason as well. But the bottom line is that seriously is that President Obasanjo saw this as a huge threat to the, I hate to say this, the good old boy network in Africa, leaders who cynically use their citizens for their own personal and political gain. And this indictment, as well as the detention of Charles Taylor, is now the beginning of the end of possibly impunity in Africa.
On the issue of Nigeria, just to be devil's advocate a little bit, I also think it's worth considering that the United States government and other governments did push the Nigerians into offering him asylum. And I'm wondering whether Professor Rashid might want to add a few words on the issue of Nigeria. And then after that, Mr. Banks, if maybe you want to comment on the question about the mindset of Charles Taylor and any light you can shed into that.
Did you go to school again?
On the I think on the Nigerian question, to look at solely from the point of view of Nigeria is unfair, because this is, yeah. I mean, as part of Obasanjo's reluctance is that it's not only the old boys network in West Africa, this is the old boys network internationally, in terms of a set of agreements that were reached, a set of understanding that were reached for various kinds of reasons in which you have to keep chalk in Calabar until this thing settles down. What has happened is, and again, as smart as Charles Taylor is, what he didn't realize is that in politics, everybody has a price and everybody has a value, and that value lasts insofar as it's expedient. What happened was Charles Taylor ran out of time, and it became politically inexpedient from all parts, all of the players, from the United States, from Nigeria, and from those who have supported him in West Africa, to say, this, we don't want anything. So basically, the Nigerians gave him up under circumstances under which they did very reluctantly. They had to set Charles Taylor up with the escape, because it would have been very difficult for Obasanjo to pick him up in Calabar and turn him over. So part of, again, as you rightly point out, I mean, there's a process which, as insiders in West Africa, you understand that there are different levels of politics. You have to set up Charles Taylor with an escape, and you have to pick him up to say you violated, I mean, the rules of what's going on, so we can, so there are different levels, and again, this is at the levels at which politics play, this is some of what's going on, but Nigeria fits into that, but the other point, again, is really sort of the balance of international and West African obligation, because only parts of West Africa in the middle of the crisis, I mean, in terms of Nigeria's position and where Nigeria draws its cachet from West Africa, is the sense is that in the middle of the conflict, when the conflict started in Liberia, is that the international community had abandoned Liberia. When the conflict started in Sierra Leone, the international community had abandoned Sierra Leone. Thousands of Nigerians died in both Liberia and Sierra Leone. We would never know how many Nigerians died. So there is, in a sense, that willingness of Nigeria to take fire in the middle of the conflict is partly where Nigeria draws its cachet. I'm not saying that the politics of old boys network is not going on. Ghana was unwilling to turn him over, and the Ghanaians are a better regime than most regimes in West Africa. But the issue that you point out, to North-South issue, is the ability to see that once the North or the international community takes a position, is that they're willing to defend that particular position. I mean, the arrest of Charles Taylor, in so much as I suppose, is highly symbolic. And one of the discussions that we hope that it doesn't stop with Charles Taylor, because the real work that needs to be done, that is not symbolically said that, oh, we've gone after the criminal. That the rest of the things in which the international community has committed to and needs to commit to, that it does, that this is where the real sense of justice and sort of rebuilding the lives. The point that I said in terms of this making it very, very difficult in terms of conflict resolution in West Africa is that
the international community depends on that African solution, that African way of doing it. Because, for example, in Darfur, is again, it's the will is not there from the international community in terms of saying that we have to stop what's going on in Darfur. The troops that are in the front line are the African Union troops, which are under-resourced and understaffed. So it's saying that we want to do this, the will is there, we're going to put the resources there. Then the African solution and the old boy network can disappear. And we want that any West African who functions in West Africa wants that old boy network to disappear. The only thing is, and I keep thinking about Ivory Coast, is at this precarious point then, is except the international community is now going to say we are going to fully back and stand behind that particular process at every stage, then there can never be that African solution, which provided in the case of Liberia, this is very important. Chancellor is in dock today because we had that window. We had that window through which you could begin to do peace rebuilding and peace reconstruction in Liberia so that this moment of Chancellor's capture can happen. So I think we need to keep that in perspective.
Ambassador Klein, do you want to add a word to that?
I think it's important to note, as you know, Charles Taylor is not a Liberio-American, nor is he necessarily a native Liberian. He comes from elsewhere, and that elsewhere is probably family in Nigeria. That's item one. Item two, as I said during my presentation, chiefs do not turn in chiefs. So that's a very bad precedent. And Charles Taylor knows a lot. He knows a lot about too many people. Is this someone you usefully want to have on the witness stand, suddenly charismatically defending himself, saying, I was not alone, I was the leader, but so those things. Now, at the same time, we spoke to the Nigerian government about a year and a half ago, and we had what I thought was an elegant solution. One, we thank you for what you did. No one else was willing to do it, by the way, so it's easy to criticize Nigeria, but no one else would take Taylor. That's done. But there are preconditions on your hospitality, and here's what they are. Now, since that time, Charles Taylor has had an hour-long TV show. Two Nigerian businessmen are suing because they were tortured in Sierra Leone. The legal community is turning against you. The academic community is turning against you, et cetera, et cetera. You can now, Mr. President, be in a win-win situation. Mm-hmm. You did the right thing then. Now you throw his ass out. You're doing the right thing now. And they said, no, I'm not going to buy it. And we would have gotten the international community fully support, saying Nigeria did it right twice. But it was not acceptable at the time, so that is a dilemma. The other question that should be asked was, how long did he think he could stay in Nigeria? This was not open-ended, obviously. At some point, he knew he was going to have to make a run for it, and obviously he had prepared for it. We knew he was in constant communication with people in Liberia, on the telephone, regularly, which is also a violation of the terms of the hospitality. But I think he would have planned this and knew at some point in time the push was going to come to shove and that he would have to make a run for it. He is charismatic. There's no doubt about that. And you and I know with young people, if you've ever taught young students in secondary school, two things young people respond to. Peer pressure. I want to do what my friends are doing, regardless of culture or ethos or religion or family. And charismatic leader. Give me a charismatic leader. And that's what the advantage he had. And what we have to do is demystify him in court. Show as we go through trial what he really is and was and did. And I think that will do a lot to demystify his personality in the region.
So, what can you tell us about the mind of Charles Taylor?
Yeah, well, he's already said it. I just throw a short comment before I get there again on the Nigerian thing. I think because I fully agree with what Ishmael has said. I'm mystified, really, as to what precisely was the understanding that was reached that got Mr. Taylor out of Liberia. I've seen no documentation. My impression at the time had been that we'll give Mr. Taylor asylum as a condition for getting him out of there. And I thought that from the Nigerian perspective, if you're acting as a mediator and you're putting your integrity on the line, to go back on it presents a difficult situation for you. So that if Nigeria easily said, all right, come and get Mr. Taylor and carry him, in other instances, where there might be turmoil in Africa, there will be a situation where people will be reluctant to trust the Nigerians at their word. And I thought that this was a difficulty that rarely President Obasanjo faced. I may be wrong, but I thought that it was more a reason why they had a reluctance in turning Mr. Taylor over. There might have been other reasons. I recall that, again, as Ishmael has said, there was an attempt to serve the vice arrest warrant on Mr. Taylor when he had gone to Ghana. Mm-hmm. And the Ghanaian government, as I understood it, did not allow that to happen. I think they had a problem of whether people would trust them. They had invited the parties over to come to this conference and see if they could resolve the issue. And there they were faced with this arrest warrant. It was the question of, do we turn this man over and have him tried? He knew the arrest warrant was out. He had gone to Ghana, I believe, on the representation made by Ghana that nothing would happen to him. So it's a complicated thing. And let me add that I don't think it's too great a African boys want to keep a club or whatever it is. I recall when the Liberian Civil War started, Mr. Doe was then in authority. Mr. Doe wrote the United Nations and asked for the intervention of the UN. We have that documented. They said, we're not going to intervene. It is an African problem. Get Africans to intervene and find a solution. He wrote President Bush. In fact, he was even motivated to write Mrs. Bush. After he didn't get a response from President Bush, he wrote Mrs. Bush. Say, I wrote your husband. He didn't respond. Please get him to have some intervention, but there was none. I think maybe there might be some other reasons, but I thought maybe that was probably some of the consideration by the Nigerians. As far as Taylor himself is concerned, I think Jacqueline has put it appropriately. He's charismatic. He loves power, but he's very charismatic. And frankly, that was one of my own fears about this trial in Sierra Leone. Mm-hmm. I watched his display on CNN, and I said to folks, I know when leaders went into Liberia to attempt mediation, they went up to Banga and saw Mr. Taylor. When they came back to Monrovia, where we were, they didn't want to see us. I mean, that's how bad it was. This included Jimmy Carter. I mean, he would get there on during the morning hours. He would go up and see Mr. Taylor, and he would come back at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the evening, and he said, well, I only have 15 minutes to spare with you fellows. I mean, this was how the man functioned. He very charismatic. You sit with him and he talks to you, and if you don't know him or don't know better of him, you will believe everything he says. And that makes his trial a rather, you know, for me, a problematic one in Sierra Leone. Because even for people who he had harmed, they might end up with the kind of charisma he has, being sympathetic to the man. We know what happened during the course of our own election. You kill my mom, you kill my pa, but I'll vote for you anyway.
That's right.
I mean, part of it was fear, but again, this was the man who was moving all around the place, distributing food stuff and bags of rice and talk to people, and people didn't perceive him as the kind of person we knew he was. So that's in my opinion, that's part of the danger that presents for a trial in Sierra Leone.
Let me maybe take three questions in a row here so we can get a few more questions on the table for the panel.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Paul Ndiha. I'm from TV to Africa, and my question is directed to you, Mr. Crane. The question is not about Liberia, but it's also about war crimes committed in the Congo. I just wanted to get your reaction about the situation in the Congo, or if the UN plans at some point to set up a special tribunal to try the presidents of Uganda and Rwanda for their crimes committed in the Congo. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I'll take a few questions in a row.
Hello, my name is Rob Talpaley. I'm a journalist with the Washington and former newspaper. Mr. Banks, you alluded to your disappointment in the UN for not indicting Charles Taylor in 1992. I think I'd probably go a step further and say that I'm disappointed in the United States as well for being complicit in Taylor's destruction of Liberia, because in my initial research, I've wondered, how does Taylor escape from a maximum security prison in the United States in the mid-1980s? There's no evidence of how this happened, who aided and abetted him. That's my question, is in the creation of this monster, wasn't the United States also complicit in this process as well? My second question is for David Crane. As a constituent in the African American community, I'm assistant editor of an African American weekly that comes out every Thursday. You alluded to the fact that there might be racial implications if Taylor is tried in The Hague. I'd like to know if you can elaborate on that specifically. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've always wondered how he got out of jail, too. my name is David Aronson. I'm with the U.S. Institute of Peace here. First, let me call out a thank you to Jacques Klein when he said something about the crimes posing challenges or questions for humanity. I think that's one of the very first times I've ever heard any white Westerner say this what's happening there poses questions about who we are. So often there's a sort of that's what Africans do, not what does this mean. But my question is this: stipulate at the outset that there's a great deal of rubbish that's swept under the rug of demands for cultural respect. The fact is that a lot of times these courts do tend to rely on what are said to be sort of transcultural human rights norms, but which are in fact largely derived from the West. And I'm wondering to what extent, if at all, you see a disjunction between local and indigenous notions of human rights and justice and political legitimacy and these transcultural ones. And then secondly, what mechanisms, David Crane spoke about the mechanisms, some of the mechanisms in place to get the information out. I'm wondering about mechanisms that you can use to actually promote or help expedite a transformation in regional notions of political legitimacy and so on.
Why don't we take the final two people standing up and add those questions to the list?
Daniel Serwer from the U.S. Institute of Peace. I want to ask about the impact of the trial and the broader question of whether there are other Taylors out there and what could prevent them from emerging. What do you think the impact of the trial will be on potential new Taylors? Will it be to make them hold on tighter, prevent themselves from being displaced from power, or will it make them realize that they could be held responsible? And secondly, speaking more broadly, a trial is just a trial, no matter how important it is. How do you prevent future Taylors from emerging?
Mary Mullen with the Bosnia Support Committee. I just wanted to ask Mr. Klein, what is the difference between apprehending Charles Taylor and Kardash and Mladic? What is the difference? Why aren't we getting Kardash and Mladic?
Okay. Why don't we hold on with more questions and get these addressed. David, do you want to start? There were a couple specifically for you, one about war crimes in Congo. Mm-hmm. And another about racial implications of moving
move moving the trial to The Hague.
Yes, good. Thank you. If you think Sierra Leone and Liberia are bad, Congo is far worse by a factor of, well, I don't even know what the factor is. The numbers are 3 to 4 million at this point. We don't know because we are, there are places in the Congo, as you well know, that we just don't go. I mean, nobody goes. I think we had a very important minor victory, I think, when the rebel leader was moved to the International Criminal Court, one of them, for appropriate justice. That was a step in the right direction. But the ICC largely has the jurisdiction on this and is going to be looking at this and continuing. So they're aware of it and they know about it. So I think that that's very important. But just as an aside, something to think about, and let's continue to dialogue this in the future. And that is, in my travels talking to various leaders and ministers, their comments were, you know, well, if we, in the future, if we have a problem, we'll just give it to the ICC. Be careful of that. That's a huge, huge statement. You know, the prosecutor can only handle 2 to 3 cases any one given time per year. How the beast of impunity is going to be faced down is these regional hybrid international tribunals, which the prosecutor certainly agrees in the principle of complementarity. So we need to be very much aware of this. We just can't say, well, we now have an IC, we have a criminal court, we'll just deal with it. They can't. The racial implications, well, they're there. I mean, you have to be honest about it. You have a black African leader being tried by an international court, though it's a hybrid international court, and there are Africans throughout the court. A third of my office is from Sierra Leone. The statute contemplates Sierra Leonean judges both at the trial and the appellate level. So it is somewhat there. I think it's lessened by the fact that it is the special court for Sierra Leone and is made up of many, many Africans. Half the court itself is Sierra Leonean, and if you added the other African colleagues in my office, it almost raised the level of about 45%. So again, yes, it's there, but I don't think it'll be as obvious. I think it'll be more obvious if it's in The Hague than it is in Freetown. Frankly, I've never seen the racial card thrown in the entire 3 years that I was there because of the fact that it was the hybrid in nature. So I think that's important. Very good question here about the cultural approach. You know, the question we need to continue to ask ourselves as we begin to shape and mold new initiatives to face down the beast of impunity and the hybrid internationals is the justice we seek, the justice they want. And we constantly have to consider that as we plan and develop the mandate. And lastly, you know, people tend to look at these things, well, now we're trying Charles Taylor, we tend to look at this from the top down versus the bottom up. Yes, there may be a potential warlord out there that may not want to give up power, but just think of the empowerment now that Africans feel. That what we're saying is that to the people of Africa, the wonderful people of Africa, that they matter. And I think that's so important. Their lives matter. And that if someone goes after them or does something to them, that something will happen. And I think that that is, like I said, the beginning of the beginning of the end of impunity in Africa. Thank you.
Philip, do you want to take on the question, thank you, of U.S. complicity in Taylor's crimes, and maybe also if you have anything to say about the impact of a trial on any nascent mini Charles Taylors that are lurking?
Frankly, there are varying views on how Mr. Taylor really escaped. Those will need to be looked into. I've suggested to some folks who have advanced various opinions about the reason for his escape, that perhaps it may be time to start asking the authorities in the U.S. to have access to the records that indicate how Mr. Taylor left jail. We understand he traveled on an aircraft, how he got through the airport. One theory is that it had gotten to a point where Mr. Doe was becoming a difficult problem. And there were decisions that it was time to remove Mr. Doe, and Mr. Taylor happened to be a person that was identified as having to go and see if he could remove Mr. Doe. Now, that's one theory. There's no verification for that. Like I say, I've suggested have access to the records and see precisely what happened. When I've talked to some of Mr. Taylor's folks, they have given indications that this was not just another jailbreak. This was a planned activity. Again, that's something that that I can confirm. As far as I'm concerned, those are all theories and speculations. There are no records to back them.
Jack, I think there are a couple of questions specifically for you. One on apprehending Taylor as compared to Karadzic and Mladic. And perhaps you may also want to talk about the impact of the trial on future warlords.
The Taylor thing was important. In other words, in the fall of 2003, John Blaney, who, by the way, an exceptional American ambassador, really did a superb job in Liberia, a man who would not leave even when his government ordered him to leave. He said, I'm not leaving, I'm not deserting the Liberians again. In any case, we were lobbying the Hill, and we got this 425-some million, 225 million for peacekeeping, 200 for John for infrastructure, and then the Taylor money. But then the question was, you know, when someone asked, like, there's 2 million now for Charles Taylor, dead or alive, you know, and then here was like, who's Charles Taylor? I mean, that name is not familiar to us. If there is a Charles Taylor, we'll certainly look into it. Yes, there is a Charles Taylor. We've discovered that he does exist. But we're extremely concerned about vigilantes and things of that sort running amok in Nigeria, and therefore the bounty would only come into effect if he left Nigeria. It was very waffled. People in Monrovia were delighted because it said that black African lives are also worth something. It isn't just Mladic and Karadzic and Milosevic and these thugs in the Balkans, you know. Now, as far as Mladic and Karadzic go, they're protected, obviously, by the Serbs. They're just protected. There's a Robin Hood syndrome, whether we like it or not. Mladic is not a military officer, as far as I'm concerned. He's a killer and a butcher. But the point is that they're going to continue to protect him until the Europeans and the United States puts enough pressure on Serbia, EU membership and the other things, to turn him over. I mean, that's just a reality. Sometimes you're lucky. We brought in the first indicted war criminal in the former Yugoslavia, Slatko Dugmanovic, in Vukovar, killing 200 Croats. And I'm surprised. At that point, even some of the Serbs said, you know, we're glad you got him because he was a killer. He was indeed a bad man. I'm still worried about the Taylor trial's impact on Liberia because Elanoni actually received 35.4% of the vote. You know, wasn't that great? One of the other parties, the CDC, took 10 of 14 seats in Monserrato. Grad Getty went for George Weah. Bong and Great Mount went heavily for Massacoin, the NPP. Now, you've got a scruffy bunch here. You've got the Speaker. You've got Mrs. Taylor's in the Assembly. You've got General Peanut Butter, Adolfo Zdolo, in the Assembly. You've got Mr. Gboli, who is the former Taylor police chief there. This is the dynamic of Liberia that she has to work with, that they're all there. Now, Prince Johnson, who you know is the chap who schnitzeled and cut up dough, actually came to see me about a year and a half ago. My chief of staff said, someone wants to see you. I said, who is it, Prince Johnson? I said, not that. Oh, yeah. I said, bring him in. I said, what are you doing here? He said, I'm here to effect reconciliation with the Doe family. I'm a minister now. God has spoken to me. I have a church in Nigeria and a following. I said, well, just stop there. You know. My grandmother used to always say, when you speak to God, it is called prayer. When God speaks to you, it is called schizophrenia. You've got to be very careful here. So I said, now, are you aware that George Dewey is Doe's cousin and Jackson Doe is a minister of state and there are 12 other Doe's here? I said, if they find you, they're going to kill you. And I can't protect you. I can give you regional security. I can't give you personal security. I suggest you leave and we'll see that you get to the airport. And then he looked at me very seriously. You know, as people do. He said, "May I ask you a personal question?" I said, "Look, everyone else does." He said, "Have you found Jesus?" I said, "I didn't know he was lost." How the hell do you answer a question like that? So, but I think Ellen has a problem here, the dynamics of putting together a government now, finding the international credibility so that donors respond to Liberia's need, because they failed Liberia time and again. I have found, for instance, talking about the U.S. foreign, no consistency in foreign policy. None. None whatsoever. Doe was given $450 million because he was anti-communist. Doe could not spell communism and thought was Marx was one of the Marx brothers. So, I mean, you know, this is what you're dealing with here. So it would be time now to set a new path. Liberia has done a lot for the U.S., both in rubber and Roberts Field in World War II, transiting aircraft. The port itself was built by the Navy to interdict access shipping in the South Atlantic. Liberia deserves better than it's gotten. And benign neglect is not the answer. Yes, there are the problems in the world. But this is really an outreach, in a sense, of the United States. I mean, they returned to Africa to do what? To build a democratic state in Africa. And I think they've been let down terribly over the years. I mean, when I think of Charles Dunbar, King was elected president in Liberia with 249,000 votes. There were only 15,000 voters. That's in the Guinness Book of Records, by the way. I mean, and native Liberians couldn't vote until the end of World War, until 1946. You know, I mean, there have been a lot of historical problems, but they need to be addressed. Land reform, citizenship, investment. Liberia is rich. Gold, diamonds, timber. 15% of the arable land is utilized. But what it needs is peace, safe, secure environment, international investment. And that's the key to giving them. When Kofi called me to do this, he said, "Look, West Africa is falling apart. The whole damn region is unstable, and it's destabilizing further. We've got to start somewhere." And I think he has always forgotten that he, on the phone with Kaba Kufuor and Mbeki and Obasanjo and these others, said, "Look, we need to do something. Let's start with Liberia. Let's try to stabilize it in the summer of 2003.
Professor Rashid, can you tell us how we can prevent future Charles Taylors from emerging?
And again, from both sides. The first is from the point of view of the United States and the West. Chairman Mo is not a friend of the Liberian people. This was why Reagan called Doe Chairman Mo.
That's true.
The second is Savimbi is not a freedom fighter in Angola. Fode Sankoh cannot be compared to Mandela. My dear, our dear friend, A.R. Jesse Jackson went and compared Fode Sankoh to Mandela in So the first thing is, because what they crave for and what they fight, what some of these dictators fight for, and this political adventure, is that kind of recognition and that kind of access to power. The reason why I pointed out this name is that there is, I mean, I've lived sufficiently long in this country to understand that, we're at this particular point in time in which politics is not only about real interests, but also a struggle around morality, around values. So if you're saying that your value is to promote democracy, is to ensure that the majority of the world, all of the world, live under democratic regimes, then put your, then sort of follow that with consistency. The second, if you're talking that international politics should be underlined by some kind of ethics and morality, let us see that in the way politics play. The disjunction here that I'm worried about is that the international court is driven by a particular kind of ethics and morality about human rights in the world. Is the politics that goes with that driven by those same set of ethics? One way you stop those guys from emerging is that from the earliest point is you don't hang out with them. You don't hang out with them in the way the West has hung out with them, because then they don't go to be the 50-foot giant that they do become, because all of these people, in terms of warlords, got to be the giants that they are because they have these kinds of access to power. So the first thing is you stop that particular access. The second point is really the greatest prevention against the rise of warlords like Charles Taylor, like Fode Sankoh, is to support the rebuilding and the democratic process that's going on. From the bottom, the turnout in Liberia for the first election and this second election, the turnout in Sierra Leone, is more people vote whenever the box is on the table in Africa than any part in the West. And it's a question of sustaining and supporting that particular process, because there is no great mechanism or magic formula for stopping the rise of dictators, except that particular democratic process. And beyond Charles Taylor, this is where the support, where the resources should go. Two things: consistency in international politics, and second, really supporting West Africa so that that particular process, which is ongoing, can be consolidated and deepened.
Thank you.
Peter, are you there? Would you mind sitting in for me?
The
second team is leaving. The first team is coming in.
Please come up and help us answer the remaining questions.
Your interest. That's very, very important.
Thank you. Let's take the rest of the questions that we have lined up, and we have some additional help in fielding the questions here. Welcome, Peter Pham. Thank you.
My name is Tim Ciclo. I'm a Liberian residing in the region. Formerly, I was a diplomat at the Liberian embassy. I had three questions, and one of them was specifically for Mr. Crean, but since he's gone, I'm going to ask the other two. First to you, Professor Banks. The UN report on Carter Camp, which those of us who were in the government, I mean, their conclusion was different from the interim government, and we know their conclusion was wrong. I went to Carter Camp in 1994, and I saw the camp. I talked to AFL personnel and other people in Firestone, and I knew definitely the massacre was carried on by the MPFL following the orders of Taylor. My question is, why didn't the government aggressively pursue their position to discredit the UN report? Or what is it that we can do now? Because all of this will go towards resolving the Liberian issue and putting this Taylor issue to rest, bringing a closure to it. The next question I have has to do with setting up a similar court for Liberia. As everyone is saying, until we have a court in Liberia that will address those other issues, those other crimes that were committed by warlords who are not in the government or who are private citizens, the Liberian crisis will not come to a full conclusion. What can we do as Liberians and friends of Liberia to set up another court to bring this to closure? Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Samuel Abu. I'm from the Embassy of Liberia. I have a little problem with those who are trying to insist for Mr. Taylor to be tried in Sierra Leone. Professor Rashid said earlier that he doesn't have any problem with security. He doesn't have security problem because Foti Sanko had more supporters in Sierra Leone and nothing happened to him. Things happened naturally. And now Taylor is there. There is no fear. But one thing I want to also say is that Mr. Taylor is a unique individual from all instances where he has been moving, come from jail, go launch a war, come up, people vote for him, he leaves power, goes in exile, and he stands over being the first and all of this. That makes him, and during his rule in Liberia, he did go on radio, and we have him on record where he said, if anybody thinks that he is mischievous, he, Charles Taylor, is the most mischievous. Okay, and we still have this in record. And what Taylor has done for Liberia is he continues to have you very, very much poor. He makes you to become very poor. You're in need of money before he brings money to you. He makes you very hungry before he gives you a bag of rice so that you will always get on his side. He continues to use his money. We believe that they were not able to stop the flow of his cash. He continues to run businesses, and the money continues to come to him. And as long as Taylor still has money, he will continue to make his way through. Sierra Leone has too many poor people. The Mongolians and whoever are there mining the coal there are all from poor countries. We still believe if Charles Taylor was able to use money to find his way out in Nigeria, continue to live there comfortably, continue to support people, he goes to Sierra Leone, and the longer rope we give him, the more mischievous he becomes. So how do you think we can easily handle Charles Taylor's
money problem to ensure that he becomes cash-driven so that he will not be able to use it as a means to leave from Liberia or to leave from Sierra Leone or to buy time so that in future we forget about him. He does something else that is very much and more mischievous.
Thank you. Why don't we make this the last question, and then we'll give our panel a chance to respond. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thanks to the Institute for Peace for convening the session. It's been incredibly informative. Well, my question follows well on my colleagues there. It's about following the money. And there are estimates, well, from UK-based Global Witness and others, that there's over $3 billion from Taylor and his cohorts that are in international banks. And, okay, maybe the funds have dwindled over the past year and a half or so. But my question is really in terms of tracking, tracing, and then repatriating the stolen assets that rightfully belong to the Liberian people and can help get the lights turned back on and all the rest that's needed there. If the panelists could comment on that, I think it would be really interesting to hear their thoughts. I'm also wondering, particularly from Councillor Banks, your thoughts on the questions of the ICC. We heard today that the prosecutors can only handle two or three cases at a time. Clearly, the issues of the Liberian war crimes have to still be taken into account. The question to you really is, would you support another sort of special ad hoc court, or would you be in favor of linking more to the ICC in terms of the Liberian war crimes? Thank you.
Could you introduce yourself?
Sorry, Emira Woods from Liberia, but working with the Institute for Policy Studies.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Start with the questions of, there were a couple of questions regarding a court for dealing with the crimes that occurred in Liberia. One question was, what can Liberians do to help make that happen, Liberians and friends of Liberia? And also, what do you think is the appropriate mechanism? Should there be an ad hoc tribunal established? I'm not sure whether the ICC is really an option, but what other options might there be?
With regards to the first question, the government did make representation to the United Nations with regards to the Carter Camp massacre. In fact, an elaborate rebuttal was prepared and was submitted to the United Nations. Like I said, unfortunately, not much came of it. It was difficult to effect an arrest on Mr. Taylor, although a warrant had been issued for his arrest and for those who were identified as being associated with the massacre. At the time, you were fully aware Mr. Taylor controlled about 80% of the country. We had an ECOMOC force there, but without the support of the United Nations, it was difficult to have Mr. Taylor arrested and prosecuted for those crimes. So that was the difficulty that we faced, really. As far as Mr. Taylor's funds are concerned, I believe that this is a decision that the government needs to take, not just Mr. Taylor, but all individuals who have taken away substantial funds from the nation illegally. I have suggested to the new government that perhaps hope they'll take it into consideration. What they might do is establish immediately a corruption commission. That commission would have the authority to propose guidelines for the operation of government officials, but it would also have the powers to investigate the conduct of past officials. I recall that when the interim government of national unity was set up in 1990, one of the first thing that I did as the Minister of Justice and Attorney General was to contact a law firm that we believed had experience in tracking down the wealth of past officials. Unfortunately, we didn't go too far with that because there were accusations that we were attempting to go after a particular ethnic group of the country, and the feeling was that with that kind of accusation, there was a strong possibility that more conflicts would be generated. I insisted on pursuing the course, but the government was one where we attempted to operate by consensus because it was made out of all of the political parties and interest groups. I guess the fear was not to generate more upheaval. So we didn't go far with that. But yes, I have the strong belief that there is a need to go after those funds. I've said to people even with regards to the present government that the mere declaration of asset, in my opinion, isn't enough to fight the corrupt activities that's going on. That these people must take an oath, they must swear to it. There must be a commission that would request a declaration every year. There must be a law that assumes that a person must be corrupt if after you've made a declaration and you say you have $50,000 and 1 year later you have $1 million and we know that you could not have otherwise accumulated that $1 million. So, these are all things that I guess need to be put in place that would help the government tremendously. Finally, I think, yes, I would propose the setting up of an international war crimes tribunal for Liberia. I stated earlier that I thought the mandate of the Special Court in Civil Union was circumscribed and they could not address the problems that we had gone through. And if there is a reluctance in expanding the jurisdiction of that court, then yes, we should start to consider setting up a tribunal for Liberia. And I think this should be an initiative, perhaps maybe not immediately, but it should be an initiative that is taken by Liberians. I know the Civil Union thing came up because of the tremendous interest that the United Kingdom had in it and took it through the EU and all of that. Perhaps maybe we can get President Bush to generate some interest in it. He seems to get these results every time he shows some interest.
We have just a few minutes left. Sure. I'd like to divide them between Professor Rashid, and then we'll give Professor Pham both his first word and the last word at the end.
Just quick comment on setting up a special similar court in Liberia. I believe that the Mrs. Johnson's government is thinking about that this is a mechanism that Liberia might need. The only thing that I want to weigh in on is that in Sierra Leone you had two transitional justice models that were sometimes a logged and did not cope with very well. And you know that truth and reconciliation commissions, are taking place all around the world, and they're actually on a grid. The South African model says that for those who are willing to come before the commission, that those people can get amnesty or could be prosecuted, and Liberia can do it sort of a lot more efficiently, I think, than maybe some of the ways we've done it in Sierra Leone, and can be able to sort of make the process far-reaching in the sense that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission could be done closer to the South African than to the Liberian model, and whatever
special court is set after that is linked to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The problem for Liberia is the scale of the problem, as in Sierra Leone. Second is resources and the kinds of institutions on which to anchor this. Again, with the special court in Sierra Leone, as you said, there was a clear commitment to do this in Sierra Leone. Where would there be a clear commitment of resources to that kind of court if it's set up in Liberia, especially given the scale of Liberia's needs at this particular point in time? Where is international money going to go? The other point, again, in terms of accountability, there is the Gacaca model, which is the local community-based model on the other side. I think other than Sierra Leone, I think Liberia should think very well how we can do this effectively and efficiently and not sort of duplicate the Sierra Leone model. Last point again, in terms of the first question that was asked, okay. In terms of security, on the security for Charles Taylor in Sierra Leone, I do understand, of course, in terms of the flow of cash and what Charles Taylor can potentially use that cash to do, but I very much support tracking the flow of that particular money and seeing whether or not that flow could be stopped. The second point, I'm still of the view that as wealthy as Charles Taylor is and as charismatic as he is, he's going to face people in Sierra Leone who are not necessarily within that orbit of his charisma. And as I said, you could do it in West Africa. You need to increase the security around the court. I don't think there's a lot of people, honestly, in Sierra Leone who have an investment of springing Charles Taylor outside the country. It would have to be external people. And to stop external people, you do two things. One, you make sure that the UN plugs the Liberian border with Sierra Leone. And the second is you make sure that the detail around Charles Taylor is sufficiently strong enough.
Thank you. Professor Pham, could you give a few words from your perspective?
I certainly would join my colleagues in supporting the court for special court for Liberia. And in fact, it would have certain advantages that the special court for Sierra Leone does not have. The special court for Sierra Leone, despite the fact that many of us would argue amnesties for crimes against humanity are invalid on their face, the special court statute for Sierra Leone specified that the amnesty provisions of Lomé applied, so its jurisdiction was from 96 onward. Liberia never had such provisions in any of the 13 failed peace agreements of the Civil War period, so a Liberian court could potentially review the entire history of the conflict in that country and provide a record not only for itself but for the region, that the special court, even with the concise indictment of the 11 counts, cannot do with Taylor. So that would be a plus. The special court could also help the question that Professor Rashid pointed out of capacity in Liberia. We've seen in Sierra Leone it is not only going to leave a physical building as a capacity, but the involvement of Sierra Leoneans throughout the process. And I think that's especially important in Liberia, where the judicial system is, in point of fact, in ruins right now. You know, important report came out on how to help rebuild that just yesterday from the International Crisis Group. But certainly the presence of the capacity building court, even though that were not its primary mission, certainly what Professor Crane did in Sierra Leone was amazing, going out and in essence, as I've called it, turning the court into an NGO, in essence, by going out and developing mechanisms for contact with the people. And that's one of the reasons why I would agree with Professor Rashid that as long as the security arrangements are beefed up, carefully reviewed, and contingency plans are made, for example, if there's regional instability, we have to watch what's going on in Guinea, for example, then you know contingency plans are made to move. But ideally, to have the trial there in Freetown so the people can come and watch. And also, those of us, we have the luxury here in the West, we forget sometimes, I know many of you are African or have experience in Africa, but we tend to forget even when we come home that we flip the TV channels and surf our 100 and some odd cable channels. When you're in a place like Freetown, unless you have one of us with a big satellite dish hanging out of your house, how are you going to, without the physical presence of the court, how are you going to follow that? Its impact, its meaning, its message is going to be diluted. So I would join with him in favoring in as so far as possible, holding the trial in Freetown and following that up with a concerted effort, which I'd invite people here to push for, something for Liberia, so that if and when Charles Taylor is found guilty, that that's not the end of Charles Taylor, in a sense. We have to do the accounting for Liberia.
Thank you very much, and thank you to all our panelists for an excellent discussion.